Coming up on this week's show, the easiest Sega Saturn hack ever.
The Blockbuster Video Game Championship returns.
And we get memories of Atari with YouTuber Control Alt Reese.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every Friday with our incredible friends at Bitmap Books. Now, one of their books that's getting reprinted next month, if you missed out on this, don't miss it second time around, A Guide to Japanese Role-Playing Games. At over 652 pages, this is their largest, most ambitious book to date and covers all the subgenres of this incredible genre. You can check that out on the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. And with our friends at PCBWay, who offer a fully featured custom PCB prototype service, and they have low-cost, fast-turnaround quality boards, and they do stuff like 3D printing and injection molding. And you know they're big supporters of the retro community. So get an instant quote for your project right now at PCBWay.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 346, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And a very warm welcome to this week's show, our final one of September, amazingly, as the nights get a bit darker and those horror video games are poised to make a comeback next month as we count down to Halloween. And of course, this podcast, every week, we take you behind the scenes on the world of classic video games and technology, bring you up to speed on all the big happenings from the world of retro over the last week, and we bring you a special guest on the show as well. I'm pleased to see that Joe Fox is joining us this week. He's come out of the metaverse briefly to do a podcast with us.
I took a step into the 21st century this week and bought myself a MetaQuest 2 as a little bit of a treat because I've had a lot of stuff going on. It's all been resolved. I've got a new job, etc. So, a little bit of celebration. And I've been, as you guys can imagine, coming into the 21st century with the height of technology, playing retro games in VR. I've been playing,
of course.
Yeah, I've been playing Resident Evil 4, and I need some recommendations on some other retro games to play on the Quest with my wife.
Dactyl Nightmare is the one that you want to play.
Back from the Nightmare?
No, Dactyl Nightmare. That was one of the first kind of VRs that was that came out on an old system, and they've recreated it now.
Oh, wicked.
I don't know if you can get it on that one, but
I'll check it out.
Yeah, it's a 90s one. You'd really enjoy that.
That was on those virtuality headsets, wasn't it? You and I have played that, Ravi.
Yeah.
It's slightly seasick.
Oh, okay. I've been all right. You know, the only kind of modern VR I've actually played is your PS4 one, Dan. And that gave me, like, you know, motion sickness a little bit. But this one hasn't given me any motion sickness at all. Like, I don't know if it's because it's, a bit different, you know, like different technology, or because you're not tethered and, you know, you can kind of move about a bit. But I've not had any motion sickness from it. I've been playing it too much. I played it before I went to bed the other night, and that was a really big mistake. Lying there, like,
just don't fall asleep in a virtual reality headset. That's my advice to you. Having done that once in VR Doom, and then woken up to the shock of my life.
Oh my days! So, I'll see if Doom's on there. VR Doom. That'd be interesting. But yeah, give me your retro game recommendations for MetaQuest 2. See what it's like.
Well, you know, virtual reality has been around a long time. Of course, you know, we talked about the virtual reality headsets that I remember playing in the arcades back in the 90s. And actually, our guest this week, we're going to be talking a bit about VR on a home system. Because did you know, and I'm sure you guys did, that actually there was going to be a home virtual reality headset released by Atari back in 1994 on the Atari Jaguar?
Yeah, I know about this because I saw one of the prototypes in the Leicester Retro Computer Museum. And this week's guest, we do chat about the Atari VR, but also we chat about, like, a lot of kind of Atari prototypes as well. So there's a really kind of interesting interview because there's a lot of stuff about the console side of Atari, the gaming side, but we also get into the computing side, the difference between divisions, as well as, like, machines like the Atari Panther. Have you ever heard of the Panther, Joe?
No, I've not heard of the Panther at all. I'm completely aware of the, you know, the Jaguar VR headset that was never to come, and I knew, you know, that we'd seen it and stuff like that. But never heard of the Panther. Was it the follow-up?
It was kind of the unreleased machine before the Jaguar.
Oh, before.
That was meant to come out. And we also talk about the Atari Sparrow, which was the prototype of the Atari Falcon as well, which is really interesting.
And the Jaguar 2 that never made it to market. So, I mean, it was a really interesting company. I mean, obviously, Atari, I think we've been talking recently quite a bit about Atari 50, you know, celebrating their 50th anniversary this year, but a company that had been through so many changes and so many different directions as well. And our guest this week is an incredible YouTuber, Reese from the channel Control Alt Reese. And not only does he make these really in-depth videos talking about the history of Atari computers and consoles, he runs an amazing website as well where he's got a really load of in-depth knowledge and research about unreleased Atari prototypes like the Panther. So he's a bit of an expert on all this as well, and a huge Atari fan as well. So it's, you know, someone like me who loves the Atari Jaguar, I could have talked to him all night about the Jag. And, you know, I think if you boys let me, I'll probably have a Jaguar section on the show every week. But unfortunately,
Jaguar hour. I think so.
There's an idea. I could do my own spin-off with Reese. But yeah, it's a really interesting chat. And actually, he's been making a bit of a move into covering solar panels and stuff recently as well, because he's had like over 500,000 views on his most recent video all about solar panels. So we kind of talked to him about how he maybe, you know, is going to funnel some of those viewers into the world of Atari, maybe get some new Atari Jaguar fans that way. So he's a really interesting guest, and he's been a big part of our community as well since we started the podcast. He's a regular listener, so really excited for this one. Reese from Control Alt Reese is going to be our special guest in around 25 minutes from now. But of course, before we bring you a guest on the show each week, we like to bring you up to speed on what's been happening in the world of retro and some big headlines from over the last 7 days, including something I had to do a bit of a double take at on NME's website. I thought, what, is this a news article from 1995? But apparently not. The Blockbuster Video Game Championship is coming up soon.
I absolutely love this. So it was announced earlier this week that the Blockbuster World Video Game Championship will be returning on the 14th to the 16th of October this year at Portland Retro Gaming Expo. So in Portland, America. This is going to be brought to us by Double Jump Events in, you know, partnership with Blockbuster, which I didn't realize was still kind of like an entity. I knew there was the one Blockbuster left.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah.
That is the entity.
So, brilliant.
What they've done is they've started kind of doing like Blockbuster t-shirts and stuff like that. And they're really kind of like milking the brand. Don't you remember they did an Airbnb where you could actually stay, I think we covered that last time, in a kind of retro-themed Blockbuster Airbnb in Bend, Oregon.
I was going to say it's in Oregon, isn't it, the last one? So, but the championship is in Portland. My geography's terrible, especially with states and stuff in America, so I don't know if they're anywhere near each other. But what I do love about this is it is retro games, so it's games from the 90s, so you'd be happy to know, Dan, that there is two rounds, and the first round is a elimination on Saturn Bomberman. People have got to play through Saturn Bomberman, and if you make it through to the second round, it's a high score round on Downfall OG for the Atari Jaguar, and the top three scores will go on to receive the prizes. The prizes being top score, obviously you're the Blockbuster Video Game Championship winner, world champion, but you also win $1,000 to spend in the shopping hall if you come first, $500 for the second place, and $250 for third place. But what I absolutely love about it, and as Ravi says, kind of milking it, is they are going to set up an actual Blockbuster store, a recreation of it at the expo that you can like walk around and stuff, and, you know, look at videos and stuff like that. And as Ravi says, buy t-shirts, and you can also sign up and get your Blockbuster card, and you can also meet the manager of the last one. She'll be there making an appearance, which I love, and you can ask her questions about Blockbuster and stuff like that. But I just think it's a bit of fun, really, isn't it?
It's a genius move, like just for advertising wise. You know, we're talking about it, everyone will be talking about it in the retro games world, and to have that link and connection with Blockbuster, because Blockbuster is iconic, and I do remember going there and actually like renting games and stuff.
I
didn't even know about this championship, but now it seems like it's a thing, and kind of bringing it back, which is really nice and reminiscent. I watched one of my favorite films, Notting Hill, with Hugh Grant the other day, And yeah. He uses
you do love a rom-com.
Yeah, he uses his Blockbuster card to get into a press event. And I thought, that's a memory. Blockbuster.
I thought you were going to say, like, I watched The Wizard, you know, with like the Nintendo World Championship. No, not no, Nightingale.
Rom-coms, yeah. That's my stuff.
You know, weird, I found my Blockbuster membership card in an old wallet a couple of months ago. So I've still got mine, so I don't think that gets me to anywhere.
I didn't realise they went bankrupt in 2010. That made me feel so old that it was 12 years ago.
I thought it was like 2015 or something.
Yeah, I knew it was a while ago, but I thought like the same as you, like 2015, 2016. But no, 2010, which just made me feel old because me and my wife used to still rent DVDs and games from Blockbuster when we first started going out. And you're just like, geez.
That's the thing. So, I mean, there is obviously this last Blockbuster in the world, like you mentioned, in Bend, Oregon. And, you know, Adam Korolik, one of my favorite YouTubers, he also does a lot of stuff with them. You know, he's done videos there as well. And I think he's going to be at this event with them. I've seen him posting it on his Facebook. But I did wonder, I thought, well, how long is that going to be around for? Is there still a business for them to rent DVDs and Blu-rays in that market? But obviously it looks like they're doing the sensible thing now. They're trading on that nostalgia.
Yeah.
They're doing merchandise and they're attending expos like this, which I imagine is probably what brings in the money. And that is actually completely the right thing to do, isn't it, to keep the brand going?
The main question is, Dan, do you think they will franchise? Do you think they'll let us open a Blockbuster UK and become part of their thing? reopen the Blockbuster network?
Well, you know, we were talking about that shop that's opening in Derby, weren't we?
Video store. If you did it like a Planet Hollywood kind of cafe or restaurant, that would be really interesting with Blockbuster. And you ate off old video cassettes. You got your food brought in the cases.
What you got? I've got Return of the Jedi. Yeah.
Don't forget to rewind it. But yeah, I mean, there are still lots of empty Blockbusters around. I mean, occasionally I'll drive through a town that I haven't been through for a while and I'll see one all boarded up. And it's always a bit of a tragic sight. I mean, I see them, you know, Toys R Us stores as well. And there is always something a little bit sad about it, isn't it? The memories of even the smell of Blockbuster was a big part of it for me.
Yeah.
Going there on a Friday night, the smell of popcorn when you walk in and picking up a 2-litre bottle of Coke and getting some fresh popcorn with a videotape. It's like that is embedded in my nostalgia muscle.
Yeah, honestly, I mean, one of my early childhood memories of going there, renting Mega Drive games for 99p, and then as I got a bit older, renting PlayStation games and going home and copying them, burning them on a CD.
It's your fault they're not around anymore.
It's mine, my brother's fault, my cousin's fault, but no, I do miss it. You know, you saying now, going in, you know, getting your overpriced popcorn and bottle of Coke and stuff like that. I'd love to go do that right now.
And I think there's probably a lot of people who want to do that, you know, have got memories of it, which is, you know, obviously what they're going to be trading on. So, yeah, I think fair play to them. It's definitely a good move. So if you want to take part in that, it's only a couple of weeks away. Get that proper 90s Blockbuster experience. I'll put the details to that in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, I must apologise if I sound a little bit underprepared this week. I have been trying to tear myself away from Return to Monkey Island, which, of course, is the new Ron Gilbert Monkey Island game that came out last week. Unfortunately, I was in Barcelona when that game came out on holiday. It was our second day there. I did bring my Switch away with me, thinking, right, I'm going to get a bit of game time in. I thought, when the wife's in the shower, you know, it takes her an hour to get ready for a night out. I thought, I'll have a couple of games on it, at least an hour or two on it. Unfortunately, it took about 3 days to download on the hotel Wi-Fi. So I had been catching up over the weekend. I think I was up till about 5 o'clock in the morning playing it on Saturday night. Absolutely loving it. And, you know, no spoilers or anything, but if you love those first two Monkey Island games, I'm sure that you've already been playing Return to Monkey Island. But it looks like this might have actually kickstarted a bit of a Lucasfilm Games revival. And this is quite interesting. A few tweets that have been doing the rounds over the last couple of weeks from Craig Derrick, who is a Lucasfilm or LucasArts alumni. And he's actually dropped a couple of hints that maybe there could be a follow-up or a reboot or some kind of return of a earlier Lucasfilm game. Maniac Mansion might be coming back. Now, this is all a bit cryptic, isn't it?
Yeah, so this, like you say, it started a few weeks ago. So on the 24th of August, he tweeted, "I know that I must go back to the mansion," in capital letters. And, you know, it didn't pick up as much traction as his more recent one that was this week on the 20th of September. Where he's congratulating, you know, Ron and Dave, you know, and all the developers and stuff on the, you know, the new Monkey Island and you know, he loves it, etc. And, you know, he's discussed it and stuff like that. But then he kind of signs off the tweet with another tweet. I'm sure more will be said throughout the weeks and months ahead. But for now, I'll be standing by when it's time to go back to the mansion. And this one's picked up a lot more traction than the previous one. Yeah. So it kind of begs that question, is it just a case of he's saying, I'm here waiting, I'm waiting for the phone call, guys. Give me the call and I'm there for Maniac Mansion. Or is he saying Maniac Mansion's coming and we're working on it?
I think it's probably coming and working on it because that is such an iconic title. Like,
yeah,
you know, it's the first real use of the Scum engine. And without that engine, you know, a lot of these point and click adventures wouldn't have worked in the same way. And, you know, Lucasfilm games really, really kind of embrace the Scum engine. And this was one of those early graphical adventure games that was just so groundbreaking with, like, you know, cutscenes and amazing puzzles and just ram-packed full of humor. And we had David Fox on, and he was, you know, integral to this game, but he also worked on Thimbleweed Park as well, which was a kind of recent point and click that came out. And, you know, I think this is one of the point and clicks that's always mentioned. And, you know, Lucasfilm games, a lot of them have their roots in this as well. And it came out for so many systems and came out in 1987 as well. So,
oh, wow.
I think, you know, this is like the kind of godfather of all of those games. So it'd be really good to see this arrive and, you know, get lots of people to experience it again and, like, bring it to new audiences. That's why I think this Monkey Island new one is so good, because there's going to be kids picking this up nowadays and kind of getting involved and getting into that world and then wanting to know about the previous titles as well.
And I think it's great because obviously we had the HD remasters of Monkey Island 1 and 2, which are a great, my favourite way to play those games now. Even though I love the old graphics and everything, but just having the talking and, you know, having that modern experience with that great story. And we had stuff like there was the Day of the Tentacle.
Yeah.
Remaster that happened a couple of years ago too. So it does kind of feel like the getting round to doing remasters of a lot of these games. And like you said, Ravi, that was kind of where it all started, you know, Maniac Mansion, that was paved the way for games like Monkey Island. And I love a lot of those old Lucasfilm adventure games. I mean, I'd love to see like a new version of Loom, for example. Oh, that could be an incredible game on modern hardware. Just such a good experience. And then you had The Dig, that was obviously meant to be a Steven Spielberg movie, but was too ambitious, wasn't it, to be made into a film. So they made it into a CD-ROM adventure. Imagine what they could do with modern hardware today. So I think there's definitely scope to bring these stories and experiences onto modern hardware. And it feels like a bit of a no-brainer. They've already got a ready-made audience who'd lap it up.
Yeah, totally. And you're right. You've got that old point-and-click and nostalgic audience, and then you've got this new one as well. And there's also stuff like Full Throttle, which was just absolutely amazing. You know, each one of them has their own kind of identity. And I guess that's because, you know, LucasArts games were so connected to that film world as well.
Yeah,
cinematic.
Of course, yeah, got that cinematic style. And, like, you know, you've got the tons of Star Wars games as well that came out that they could easily bring back and, you know, get people into that alongside the Star Wars films and stuff. I'm not sure about the rights. Maybe they're with Disney. I wasn't sure. I even thought that Monkey Island was with Disney as well. And
it was, but they got it back.
Maniac Mansion as well was with Disney. So maybe they've done a deal where they've got like a lot of them in a package back or something.
It does sound like that, yeah, because I know Rob was trying to get the rights to make a new game from Disney for about a decade, and obviously it's finally happened recently. So it does sound like maybe some behind-the-scenes kind of deals happened, because they weren't doing anything with these old IPs.
Yeah,
so
like I just read in 2017, Disney actually released Maniac Mansion on a kind of Scum VM virtual machine to some digital storefronts, but that's just like, you know.
On GOG, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's not kind of what we're expecting if we're going to see one. And this is kind of a dream come true for point and click fans, really, having all these old ones revisited as well.
You know what I'm thinking, though? You know, you were talking about the Oculus Quest before. Oh, I'd love to play Monkey Island in VR.
But yeah. Just pointing at things.
Just keep picking the same stuff up. I don't know what I'm doing. I can't figure it out.
Going around the house picking the dog up.
Yeah.
So, yeah, very exciting. So, I mean, I'm a point-and-click fan. I have been. It's always been one of my favourite genres. And obviously, we did that episode, Wadjet Eye Games one recently. There's a big revival going on right now. You know, I'm hyped for the new Simon the Sorcerer game too. So the more of these, the better, I think. So we'll keep an eye on that and bring you up to speed on any news that we hear. Now, a system that I know you're a big fan of, Joe, and I'm looking over. Actually, I got my Sega Saturn set up again recently. It's just waiting on the side there to have a little gaming session on maybe this weekend. The Saturn, obviously, a system that has got a rather exotic library. There are a lot of titles that only came out in Japan, for example, that are very expensive and very hard to get hold of. And I think out of all of the systems, it is probably one where it does make a lot of sense to hack it, you know, mod that system so you can play these games without owning these expensive originals. But it's always been a system that, I mean, admittedly, because it had very hardcore copy protection that was only kind of broken in the last couple of years, actually. But really, before that, you needed to put in a physical mod chip. And I've got to say, it's not that difficult to do, because I've done it on mine. It's literally a couple of wires to put a mod chip in there. But it does mean getting your soldering iron out, and obviously things can go wrong. But now it seems like there are increasingly easy ways to hack your Sega Saturn. This one sounds like it could be the easiest one yet.
Yeah. This is this kind of SD loader. And previously, you're right, I was looking at stuff. There was Dr. Abrasive, and I think he did one which was that we covered through the VCD port, which was the video CD one, as a way to kind of crack it.
That's this round looks the back, isn't it? Like with the...
Yeah. Yeah, that's round the back, and it seemed that that had faster access as well, but this seems to be a replacement for the ODEs, which are the kind of, you know, where you're taking the drive out and you're putting an SD card in there. So this seems like a cheaper solution. What is it, Joe?
Well, I was hoping you'd tell me a little bit more about it, but just kind of on that ODE, yeah, it's pretty much, like you say, a lot of the mods, you know, you have to kind of like solder them, or like you say, take out the actual disk drive so that you then have the SD card in there instead. And obviously that means you can't play any of the physical media, you know, if you have got any Saturn games on there. But as you say, I'm not too sure how this works. It's kind of mind blowing, to be fair. I'm assuming there is some soldering in there from the video. It's, you know, they've taken it apart.
Yeah.
But you essentially, I can only describe it with as being as a podcast for, you know, layman terms, somebody like myself. You essentially plug the SD loader into the Player 2 port for the controller, and you're loading the games off an SD card, which is essentially like a memory. It looks like a memory card going into the second controller port. It's beyond me how that's working, because of it, as Ravi says, it's quick and it's working well. And this was submitted by one of our big supporters, Gareth, and he was telling us about it on the Hangout last Sunday, and it was blowing my mind. I was like, he should be sat here right now. I've got no idea how this works.
So these ODEs are quite expensive, basically. Yeah. These kind of optical disc replacements, that's what they are. So you take the whole disc drive out and then you replace that. This method is a bit more kind of hacky. And what it is you have your Pseudo Saturn Kai, which is basically an action replay cart that has exploits on it that can basically load up, you know, backups and stuff like that. That cart required, you know, a bit of modification and stuff, but now you can do it off SD cards. So amazingly, they found that if you get this little cheap SD card reader, you can actually take some of the wires out of the Saturn controller port and boot ISOs from the SD card via the controller port, which I just think is mental, onto the using the Pseudo Saturn, and then actually run backups off that little SD card. So you don't need this expensive replacement. You just use this like little cheap SD card and this cable. So hopefully they're going to be able to create a like little product that is just this kind of cable SD card in the Player 2 port. You've got your Pseudo Saturn on top of that as well. And then you've got your ultimate solution for kind of loading them. I do have a few worries with this though, which is the transfer rate. So I used to have one of these solutions that was in the back of a Dreamcast. And, you know, they created these and there were lots of Chinese versions of them that came out. It's very cheap. You could put it in the back of your Dreamcast and you could have a SD card in there. The problem was that the transfer speed was not fast enough to play the music at full speed, some of the video scenes at full speed. And they ended up creating a load of rips that didn't have the music on it and just had the sound effects and stuff. And it kind of ruined the gaming experience. I'm not sure sending data down these cables is going to be that fast. But then I guess with controllers, it's got to be fast to react. I'm just not sure they'll be able to send that much down there. But I could be proven wrong.
I mean, there's only a short demo at the moment, and it is on Twitter where they show the Sega Saturn SD loader. Weirdly, on that portable Sega Saturn that I think we've talked about in the past, which actually, as a demo, I don't think it looks as impressive as doing it on actual hardware.
Yeah.
Because you just look at that and you think, oh, how modded is that system? But really, yeah, you put an SD card into this device. You need the pseudo Saturn Kai cartridge in there. But then, yeah, you plug it into to port 2 and you get a list of CD image files that you can then load on there. And the video that we've got so far is only about a minute and a half long.
Yeah.
So we don't really get to see anything beyond him just launching a game and showing the menu. So it is work in progress at the moment. The good thing about this is a lot of it's kind of open source, the technology behind all this. So you're right, it could mean that we get a very kind of cheap hack. And people can make these, you know, and sell them on eBay for like £10 or whatever.
Yeah.
Which could be a really simple way to get the full Sega Saturn library on a little portable, essentially USB key.
Like, looking at this, Mode is one of the replacements from Terra Onion, and that's over €180.
Yeah.
For the ODE. But then you can get one of these pseudo Kai carts for like 40, 50 quid off eBay, and then hopefully a couple of quid for this little adapter. And, you know, you'll be going for like about 50 or 60 quid compared to, you know, whatever price that is and import duty and all of this kind of stuff as well. So hopefully it'll be a good little solution. I'm just kind of amazed that it's working through the controller port. I never thought of that. And maybe if they develop this VCD kind of way of loading it, you might be able to get a custom VCD card instead of the pseudo Saturn, and then, you know, have that in the back and then have this SD card, and it might even make it cheaper, you know.
The Saturn is such weird hardware, though. I love the fact that you can even do stuff like this on it. So it's early days on this at the moment, but I'll put that link to the article and the video. And, of course, the rest of the stories, you'll find them all in the podcast app show notes or at theretrohour.com. Now, more new stories to talk about, including a brand new operating system for the Commodore 64, a new commercial OS that has just been launched, and an incredible Super Mario Maker 2 level set that we need to talk about in a minute. Before we do that, though, of course, we do have a little Patreon that we run, just if you want to throw a couple of dollars, couple of euros, couple of quid into the pot to help us keep the lights on and make sure that we can bring this podcast out to you every single week. If you'd like to contribute to that, I mean, we have loads of different tiers as well, but everyone that backs us on Patreon will be welcome to, of course, the Patrons Hangout. But now October starts tomorrow. That does mean there is another one coming up at the end of the month. That'll be our Halloween Hangout. That's always a fun one to do. And we talk about so many different things on the Patrons Hangout. The most recent one was quite an interesting one, wasn't it? It was quite varied topics discussed on that.
Yeah, we. I'm not too sure how. Well, I know how it happened, but we ended up talking about people's phobias. And then we got into a great big discussion about the difference between an ostrich and an emu. And that's how we started this month's discussion. That usually happens about an hour and a half, 2 hours into it after we've all shown off everybody's tech. But it started that way this time. And then we brought it back into all the retro tech and the retro films. What did we end up talking? We ended up...
I bought a colouring book.
Yeah, you ended up buying...
This is because Matthew Coupe, is one of our patrons.
That's what Sam, we were talking about, yeah.
We were talking about the Sam Coupe, this really weird, exotic Welsh home computer that came out back in the late 80s, and how the logo, the branding, and the mascot, he was a little like robot, is now used on the series of children's colouring books that have just been re-released by someone who owns the trademarks. And they're available on Amazon. So I got one delivered yesterday. My wife opened the parcel. She goes, "Why have you ordered a kid's colouring book, you weirdo?"
You're there to colour it in.
Yeah, of course.
Well, that's the kind of stuff that I love about, you know, our Patreon. We've got such a nice community on there. And if you back us, you know, you can join the community on Discord as well. You get some extra content on the episodes and you get your own personal custom RSS feed, which you can load into your apps. And then you get the After Hours podcast, which is a whole other podcast that we do. We've recently recorded one, and that was about light gun games and shooting games, and there's some really good kind of memories about those gun games back in the days as well. So you get a lot of extra content for your money.
Yeah, so if you'd like to back us on Patreon, it's dead straightforward. All the details are at theretrohour.com. And of course, for joining our Patreon community, you will get a mention in the most prestigious high score table in the world of retro gaming. And I'll let you two guys welcome our two latest patrons who've made it into the Hall of Fame.
Hall of Fame! Thank you, Richard Baker.
And a massive thank you to Retro Passion Limited,
who've both backed us on Patreon. We hugely appreciate your support. And if you'd like to join our patrons community, all the details are at theretrohour.com. Right, our special guest, Reese from Control Alt Reese, Memories of Atari, coming up in just a minute. I must admit, this is not something I expected to see in 2022. A brand new commercial operating system for a computer that's just celebrated its 40th birthday. Have you heard about this, Ravi?
I'll tell you what.
C64 OS.
I've tried, like, I'm an Amiga guy, right? And I've tried to go back to the C64, and it's hard. Like, putting the commands in, kind of having that interface is really confusing for me. And I am an OS guy. So the fact that there's an OS for the C64 really makes me think, oh, wow. And looking at some of the features of this, this looks like a well thought out OS. You know, it's really impressive to actually come out on this machine. And that's one thing I've always struggled with, going back to the older kind of command line stuff.
Yeah, cause, I mean, the Commodore 64, you turn it on, you drop into basic. And the way you did it back in the day.
And I'm just like, load, comma, eight, comma, all of that stuff. You know, you have to really learn that. Yeah.
Yeah, there's not even dedicated disk drive commands on the Commodore 64. You know, you have to do, the comma 8, comma 1, all that kind of thing. I mean, there was a GUI released on the Commodore 64 back in the day called GEOS, which is, you know, freely available now. But this is actually a new graphical user interface that's just been released. And it's a commercial product, you've got to pay for this, by a team called Opcoders Incorporated, and it's called C64 OS 1.0. Now, what they've done is, I mean, you actually buy this as a physical product, and they ship it out with a manual and SD card as well, some nice packaging, and it comes with not only a GUI operating system, that is windows, menus, icons, pointers, you know, you use a mouse if you want to operate this, and it comes with 25 utilities that can be used concurrently with Commodore 64 OS, including all the stuff you'd expect, you know, calculator, a calendar, stopwatch, a text viewer, a memory inspector too. There's a chess game in there. But what this lets you do is, I mean, you can actually have up to four different tabbed interfaces open at the same time. So if you ever use stuff like, you know, file managers like Directory Opus, that kind of thing, or, you know, Midnight Commander on DOS, it's a bit like that, really. And there is a video that I'll link up if you want to see, because, I mean, it's quite complicated to get your head around this. But Christian from Perifractic's Retro Recipes has done an incredible, almost hour-long deep dive into this, showing all the file management, how it all works and everything too. And really, it just makes, like you said, Ravi, the experience of using a Commodore 64 a lot easier, just being able to use it like a modern machine, really.
Yeah, who said that the Amiga invented multitasking? This is
you can multitask on this.
Yeah, this is really awesome. Like, the fact that it comes with that many utilities and applications is just absolutely amazing. And, you know, I can imagine that they're going to be updating this, and they're going to be kind of adding new features. And it seems like it's kind of come out of the blue as well. I really didn't know this was in the works, and it's come as a complete package. So I remember using SD to IEC and all the kind of 1581 disk drive replacements and stuff, and trying to get it working on that. And it was quite confusing. And this, to me, looks like I could pick it up and kind of play. And also, you know, hopefully it's going to have stuff like music players for SID files in as well, which was one thing that I was...
I think it has already. Christian shows that in his video.
Yeah, that was one thing that I was really struggling to load and get running, and I really wanted to. And yeah, I can just imagine that this can grow and grow. There might even be an app store on it at one point. Seems to be an app launcher there. It's really, really nice idea. And I love this dedication to kind of older systems. And I can't imagine it, how many different configurations and, you know, different support for different bits of hardware they've had to consider, and, you know, different kind of applications that they've had to get on board. And it seems like a momentous project to build a whole operating system for an 8-bit micro. It's like, wow.
You're talking about a machine released in 1982 with a 1 megahertz 6x10 CPU, 64K of RAM, and a screen resolution of 320 by 200 with 16 colors. And they've got a full GUI, modern GUI, running on this with some multitasking capabilities as well. Now, it is a commercial operating system. They're selling this, I think it's $49 Canadian. No, $59 Canadian, sorry. So that works out about £40 with the ever-falling exchange rate here in the UK. So, I mean, some people have been complaining, oh, it's a lot to charge for it. But you, like you said, Ravi, the amount of work that must have gone into this.
And it's not like it's just going to stop. You know, it's going to continue. And, It's very interesting, and just the fact that it's got like file managers and stuff like that in there. And I think you can get like a physical copy as well. It seems to be like that what you actually get is you get like an SD card and, you know, a sticker, a printed user guide, stuff like that. But I'm also seeing that, you know, that there's the SX64 as well. I guess they might be able to run this on that tiny screen. You know, it's
it would, yeah, I'm sure it would
work on a lot of systems. And this is just like awesome for you C64 fans. Next we need to see SpeckEOS come out, and a few other more 8-bit ones as well.
Yeah, I think at the moment there is only a physical release of it. I mean, I would admittedly, because I think, you know, they are based, I've got a feeling it might be in Canada the base, because it was Canadian dollars, so obviously shipping is going to add cost to it as well. Personally, I would like it if they offered maybe a half-price digital download, so you can put it on SD card yourself, because, you know, I've got an SD card and an SD2 IC, that kind of thing. That, at the time of recording, that's not something they offer by the looks of it. It is physical only. But I think maybe to get it out to more people, that might be an idea, and maybe something they're going to offer in the future. I think it would make sense. But I think definitely anyone that's a fan of retro computing and has a Commodore 64 should get behind this and support it, because, like you said, the more people that do, the more development it's going to get. And just people dedicating this amount of effort to 40-year-old machines in 2022, I just think it's amazing. So I'll put a link to that if you want to check it out in our show notes as well. Now, I must admit, one of my favourite games to play on my Wii U, and something that I carried over to my Switch. You know, if you just want something that's just a little bit of fun and makes you feel a bit creative, I love Super Mario Maker, number one and number two. And this guy has done something that's way beyond anything I've ever managed to make in Super Mario Maker. He's actually recreated a load of old classic Mario games in Mario Maker, and he's called this Super Mario Bros. 5.
Yeah, so this is Metroid Mike 64, who started making this on the Wii U version, and then when Super Mario Maker 2 came out on the Switch, he kind of started again, kind of remade it all in Mario Maker 2. And what's really unique about Mario Maker 2 is it has the World Maker mode. So you don't just have a level and you load it in and then you play it, or you upload it and people can play it. We covered it when this came out. It has the actual full World Maker on there, which I think launched in 2020. And he said when this happened, it was like a dream became a reality. You can now make your own world map. And he's made 40 levels across 8 worlds, using levels from Super Mario World, Super Mario Brothers, and Super Mario Brothers 3. Now, this is where I get a little bit... So, are these original levels the original game's levels that he's like painstakingly remade into Mario Maker 2.
Yep, that is exactly what he's done.
Is that what he's done?
Hand remade them all, yeah, based on the originals.
Wow, that's crazy. And, you know, from what I understand, the kind of reason he's done this is because of, you know, I really enjoy Mario Maker. And I sit there, and I'm not very good at making the levels myself. Me and my wife have had a few good goes on it, and we do little silly things like you can record, you know, on the Wii U version, you can record your own messages into, like, the question mark boxes. So, like, you know, yeah. I'd make a level for my wife, and then she'd play it, and, like, I'd say silly things, you know, coming out of the TV as, like, she's running along and stuff. But I always wanted to play levels people had made. But all the popular levels were these insanely hard viral levels, you know, these videos that go viral where, you know, you've got to do these absolutely insane things. And I think off the back of that, he just wanted to make some old school classic Mario for people to play on it, you know, on a really nice version of Mario, you know, on Mario Maker 2. Like,
It's interesting. I think it's kind of pointless because these are probably out on the virtual store anyway as the original one. But it's like, look what I can do in Mario Maker, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
And, to me, I don't think it's pointless at all. I think this is what Nintendo should have done. They should have made these levels anyway in Mario Maker.
Yeah. I'm torn, but I think it comes down to you're remaking them in a really nice version of Super Mario, if that makes sense. Like, because Mario Maker is like the nicest looking 2D Mario, like the graphics on it. Although it's Super Mario World or Super Mario Bros. 3, the graphics on it look outstanding compared to even Virtual Console re-releases of it, if that makes sense.
It's in HD, isn't it? Yeah,
yeah. You know, it's old sprites and stuff, but it's new assets, isn't it? And it just looks, that 2D imagery looks so, like you say, HD, high definition, and the sound and everything on it. You know, but as you say, Dan, it would have been nice if, you know, Nintendo just kind of put them on there anyway.
I guess, I don't know what the difference between the Wii U version and the Switch one is, because I've got the Wii U version, and on the gamepad, you get all the objects to edit, and then you see it on the screen. So I don't know if that's the same on the Switch, but maybe that helped development or get it faster, or he had like a lot of modifications within the within the Wii U version. But it does look really awesome. All credit to him and stuff, but for me, I'm just like, well, Nintendo are just gonna port it and then all his work is gone, you know what I mean? But I do think it's nice, and I do really love Mario Maker. I think it's an amazing piece of software, and I'd love to see it be done for more games like Shadow of the Beast Maker
Metal Gear Maker or something like that.
Oh, Metal Gear Maker, yeah, that would be wonderful.
I love the comments on this Eurogamer article. He said, I'm sure Nintendo's lawyers are already on the way. The fact that this is a free collection of levels made entirely in their own game.
that's my whole point, yeah.
They've got to leave this one up, surely.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact you can share these worlds, and I mean, so if you want to check this out, I mean, he's poured 7 years of his life into making this, so... a lot of time and effort has gone into it. If you've got Mario Maker on your Switch, the ID is 0G9-XN4-FNF. And I'll put that in our show notes as well by Metroid Mike 64. Nice.
Road Rash Maker.
Ooh. Doom Maker. They're probably
Doom Maker.
Okay, next we're going to get some memories of Atari with the incredible YouTuber Reese from Control Alt Reese is our special guest next on the Retro Hour podcast. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time for our favourite part of the show when we welcome on our very special guest. And we always love talking to like-minded people who share our passion, share our hobby, and actually our guest this week, I know, has been someone who's been a part of our community for a good few years now as well, and we're massive fans of his YouTube channel. So let's welcome on Reese from the excellent YouTube channel Control Alt Reese. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thanks. Yeah, that's very kind of you to say. How are you?
Yeah, very good. I did see that your channel, you've almost doubled in size over the last couple of weeks due to a video that you did about solar panels. So I'm hoping that you're going to funnel kind of maybe some of those almost 600,000 viewers on that video into the retro scene now and get them into old school Atari stuff.
Oh, it's just insane, isn't it? It's completely unexpected. But yeah, I'm hoping to combine the kind of two interests in the near future, and like you say, try and bring some people across and convert them to the cause.
Well, obviously, you know, we were aware of you before when, you know, used to share our posts on Twitter and everything. We've interacted with you on there in the past, which is awesome. And then I came across your YouTube channel a couple of years ago. And even though, you know, I'm generally known on YouTube as being more of an Amiga guy, I suppose, but I've always had a big interest in Atari. I mean, I collect for the Atari Jaguar. I remember seeing the Falcon for the first time and being blown away by that. I'm looking over at my Atari ST now. And your channel, really, I guess the foundation of it is your passion for Atari's what got you started. But I'm quite interested to kind of go way back to day one in terms of your computer and video game experience. I mean, do you remember your first experience of a game or a computer, where it all started for you?
I do, yes. And funnily enough, it was Atari. So it was one Christmas at my uncle's house, and my cousin had gotten an Atari 2600 Junior for Christmas. And myself and my other two cousins literally spent all day and all night playing on this thing. He only actually had two games for it, which were Frogger and Keystone Capers. I don't know if you played Keystone Capers. It's like a platform kind of game. And yeah, that's kind of a memory that's stuck with me really for my whole life. And it's definitely evidently had some influence on me. So yeah, then from there we kind of went on and we got an Acorn Electron, which was our very first computer at home. Which didn't last very long. That one literally exploded. And then we went on and got the Atari STE.
I actually drove over an Acorn Electron a couple of years ago accidentally, and it survived. How did you blow yours up? That sounds quite hardcore.
I'd like to say it was doing something hardcore, but it was literally flick the power switch, big bang, lots of smoke. So obviously, in hindsight, I guess it was a reefer capacitor in the power supply. I think they're quite known for that, but we didn't know that at the time. Obviously, my mum was panicking and screaming that we're going to burn the house down, and quickly unplugged it all and ran outside with it, expecting it to set on fire. And I remember the whole thing being this huge catastrophe at the time. So it was quite funny looking back.
I was wondering as well, what monitor did you have? Because those kind of Paperwhite monitors were really beautiful back then. And there was a lot of Atari users I remember that had black and white monitors as well.
Yeah, so with the ST, I actually had a TV in my bedroom at the time. I think my parents had kind of learnt from their experience with the Electron that I was going to be on the computer pretty much all night, every night, playing games and doing bits of programming and stuff. So they actually got me my own portable TV to go with it. And that was kind of how I used it back in the day over RF, you know, the old fuzzy picture and everything. It wasn't until sort of much later on in life that I discovered the high resolution black and white ST monitors and that kind of stuff, which I do own now. I've got the color versions and the black and white versions, a few different variations. But yeah, I guess the same as most people sort of back in those days, it was very much on the old TV for me.
Well, you know, Atari's obviously a big part of what you do now. I mean, is it something that you've always had a passion for then? Because I mean, obviously Atari are a big part of gaming DNA. I mean, obviously celebrating their 50th anniversary this year. I mean, why are you so passionate about that company in particular, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, it's purely because of that STE that we had, I think. I mean, we had it for a few years. I think it was 1991, Christmas 91, we got that particular machine. And then I think 94, we got a 486 PC, and the STE kind of got forgotten about. And it was only a few years later when I think I was away at university at the time, and my parents were moving house and they were kind of downsizing and clearing out the loft and stuff. And I found the old ST and I was like, oh, okay. And I really got back into it in a big way. I discovered around that time that that Jaguar stuff was really, really cheap. So I started picking up an Atari Jaguar and started picking up some of the games and stuff. And that was really what kind of launched me into the whole Atari collecting thing. Yeah, around that time, the Jaguar getting back into the ST and the old 2600 stuff, because early 2000s, 2004, 2005-ish, it was, you know, you could buy this stuff for next to nothing. It wasn't selling for the silly money that it is today.
If only we knew then.
Indeed. Yeah, well, that was another thing, because obviously I was a university student. I had quite a lot of Jaguar stuff, and then When I got into my final year at uni, I sold it all because I ran out of money and I desperately needed the money. Sold pretty much my entire Jaguar collection, And now, 15 years later, I'm finally at the point where I've kind of bought it all back. But it cost me a lot more this time around.
Well, do you think there's a kind of a lot of focus on the gaming side of Atari and like, and when people talk about it in documentaries and stuff, and not that much on the desktop or like some of the great applications that were on the system?
Yeah, it's quite interesting, really, because when you look at like the older 8-bit stuff, you know, of course, everyone knows about Atari and kind of their arcade history and the 2600 and that kind of thing. But when you look at the 8-bit machines, people tend to talk about the Commodore 64 and the Apple II and the ZX Spectrum and that kind of thing. But the Atari 8-bit machines were really, really fantastic machines and really very capable machines. And they were among the first. I mean, you know, I think it was 1979, the Atari 400 and the 800 launched, which was only 2 years after the Apple II. And then, of course, it was sort of well into the 80s before we had the likes of the C64 and the Spectrum and the Amstrad machines and that kind of stuff. And of course, those 8-bit Ataris had really fantastic arcade ports, home arcade ports, because obviously Atari developed those in-house and because they owned the rights to all of those games. Whereas, you know, say on my Acorn Electron, I think we had a knockoff of Pac-Man called Snapper that was, it was actually surprisingly good, but, you know.
I remember it well.
It was Atari that had the best sort of first-party ports. And of course, those 8-bit machines, you know, they had all the full range of hardware accessories, the disk drives, the modems, printers, all of that kind of thing. You know, they had the SIO interface, which was kind of one of a forerunner to USB. In fact, I think one of the engineers who worked on SIO actually went on to develop USB, if I remember correctly. So, yeah, really, really sort of very capable and very revolutionary machines. But, you mentioned Atari to most people, and they just tend to think of the games and the 2600 and the arcade, like I say.
It is quite remarkable because we speak to developers on this show who, you know, started on the Atari 400 and the 800, and they always kind of talk about them as kind of hidden gems, really, I suppose. You know, the people that knew about them love those machines. And it's quite surprising in a way that they weren't more popular than its contemporaries.
No, absolutely. I mean, obviously, like I say, the ST was kind of my way into the world of Atari, but I've since gone back and kind of gone over that stuff, and I do have a really nice original 800. I've got the XEGS and a couple of other sort of 8-bit machines. And, I mean, that range launched in, like I say, 1979, and they sold variations of those all the way up until, like, 1992, I think. They were never sort of really huge sellers along the lines of the Commodore 64 and the Apple II, but very, very well loved and well respected and well regarded by the people that had them and the people that worked on them.
They seemed very popular in America when I went over there. There were lots of 800 and 400s, and I'd not actually seen one before. And then there was a lot of love, and people had them out, and, you know, they were doing amazing stuff on it. And I've always kind of just associated that era with like the 2600 and stuff like that.
Yeah, the 800 is such a well-engineered and well-put-together machine. I don't have a 400, but I do have the 800 here, and it's just got a really nice, solid mechanical keyboard, and it's got the expansion slots internally, and it's got the SIO interface for all of those peripherals. So a really well-engineered and really well-thought-out machine, and a really capable machine with some really good sort of graphics and sound capabilities as well.
Well, obviously, in 1983, Atari kind of split into two separate parts. You had Warner Brothers that bought the arcade division, and then Jack Tramiel, who formerly ran Commodore, took over the home division of it as well. So do you kind of think the rivalry maybe that Jack had with his previous company drove him to innovate in that home computer market?
Yeah, I think Jack was kind of notoriously a very ruthless businessman and very sort of cost oriented and that kind of stuff. I also had a point to prove trying to screw over his previous employers. Hence, you know, rushing the ST out, knowing that the Amiga was coming, and you know, trying to get that to market as quickly as possible. I know he cancelled a few things like the 5200 console. I think as soon as he got in, he cancelled that. Very kind of driven and motivated, I think.
And they got the whole kind of family behind it, didn't they? They were all working for Atari at some point.
Yeah, I mean, my understanding was that they were a family of engineers. I mean, you know, they had Leonard, who was who was directly involved in some of the programming and the technical side of things. And I think Sam was the other son, and he was kind of, I think he was kind of in charge of the ST and that side of things as well. So definitely a family business.
Yeah, well, the ST, it was kind of embraced by professional musicians. And was this kind of due to the sound capabilities and stuff like Cubase?
Yeah, so I think when Jack was kind of first, when he first envisioned the ST project, he kind of firmly had the Mac in his sights, the original sort of 1984 Apple Macintosh. In fact, the ST was known as the Jackintosh when it was first released, in reference to that. And that's why it had that, you know, those excellent sort of black and white monitors and stuff, because that was kind of the professional market that they were aiming for. I'm not quite sure where the decision to incorporate MIDI ports came from, yeah, obviously a big part of the kind of musicians picking up the machine were due to those MIDI ports. And of course, the ST had the 8 megahertz 68,000 CPU as well, so it had quite a lot of sort of processing power, especially compared to sort of sequencers and other kind of MIDI equipment of the time. And I think that sort of combined with the low cost of them, and the fact that they're, you know, fairly robust, fairly indestructible. I know I've seen video footage of people like Pet Shop Boys and the Prodigy, you know, actually using them live on stage from back in those days as well. I think it was a very wise move of Atari to kind of incorporate all of those capabilities and kind of target that market, definitely.
Because when you think of Jack Tramiel, he's you know, notorious for like penny pinching anywhere he could, wasn't he, really? So that decision to kind of put those ports on there that weren't really needed for, you know, machine targeting word processing and programming and games, it was quite an interesting choice. But obviously, like you said, I mean, it really made a market for the ST. So it's quite a curious decision why they put those on there. It will be interesting to find out maybe of someone one day.
Yeah, I think it's not something I've really researched, but I think it was essentially... Essentially, they got that functionality for free because it's built into the YM sound chip or something. It's something I really need to sort of research and cover properly in a video, because it's a whole side of the ST that I've not really explored in great detail yet. But yeah, evidently a very, very wise decision on his part.
Yeah, I was just looking at like kind of the artists that use the ST, and just some amazing names. I remember Fatboy Slim was one, but... you know, they got like Jamiroquai, Gary Newman, Bomb the Bass, William Orbit, Depeche Mode. It's like, you know, a huge list of musicians that used it, and seemed like a very kind of capable system.
Yeah, I remember seeing a video on YouTube that one of the musicians magazines had done a few years ago. I think it was around 2016-ish. And it was a studio tour that they did with Fatboy Slim, and he still had his ST set up and all of his boxes of discs and stuff. And he was apparently still using it to make music as recently as you know, like 2016-ish. So, yeah, really cool.
Well, you mentioned about Jack rushing the Atari ST out, and I know there was that kind of deal with Amiga that was originally going to be an Atari machine. I think, you know, there are mock-ups and pictures online of the Atari 1850 XLD.
Yeah.
That would have been what they were going to use those chips in. I mean, I don't know how much you know about that story, but that's quite interesting. And then obviously out of that, I mean, he decided to make his own machine, the ST. What kind of made that so special then? And what do you think any of that kind of DNA went into the ST's decisions and in terms of hardware?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I think he was more targeting the Mac. I think if they'd specifically designed the ST as purely a games machine, they probably would have done things slightly differently. I know they originally had a different sound chip in development for it, which there's a whole story about how they got screwed over and basically had to switch to the Yamaha chip at the last minute. But yeah, I think sort of the decision to rush it out before the Amiga was more a case of just trying to sort of get one over on Commodore. And of course, the Amiga 1000, which did release at around the same time as the ST, was the much more expensive machine. I mean, it was a much more capable machine. But yeah, it was three or four times the price at launch. So it's, you know, was it necessarily targeted as a direct competitor initially? I'm not sure.
It's interesting that there was that kind of UK Atari scene as well. And like, I was wondering how important people like Jeff Minter were to that, especially them being kind of a US-based company. They must have had divisions all around the world.
So I think Jeff first started. Did he do some Apple II stuff originally and some Commodore 64 stuff? I'm not quite sure what order that came in. But he was a very big supporter and sort of champion of the ST in the very early days and very sort of upon it. And later on, when Atari were developing the Panther and later the Jaguar, I know that he was actually flown over to their offices in America and sort of acted as a consultant on that at a very low level. So he's sort of always been a very well regarded and a respected figure in the Atari industry, and you know, obviously quite close connections with Atari. But yeah, of course, the UK developers at the time, we had a thriving software development scene off the back of the British computers like the Spectrum and the you know, the Amstrads and that kind of stuff. Evidently looking to branch out into something else, and yeah, picked up on the ST as well. I think back in those days, I think we definitely were sort of punching well above our weight on the software and the game development side of things. Sort of, I know there are a lot of people, sort of well-known names today, like Jeff, who did sort of cut their teeth on the ST, and that's kind of what they're best known for.
So I think, you know, the late 80s home computer and gaming scene in Britain was such an interesting place, and you had all these different companies and wild and weird devices. I mean, we mentioned Jeff Minter, and from when we interviewed him, you know, he was talking about the Konix multi-system, which was a really ambitious system that never got released. But then the team who worked on that went on to form another company, Flare Technology. They got involved in Atari, who wanted to make a return to gaming consoles around that time, didn't they? What was kind of the story there from what you know?
Yeah, so I mean, there was Martin Brennan, who was the founder of Flare Technology, and after the Konix, he was brought on board to work with Atari. Atari had started a project as a follow up to the 7800, which was kind of notoriously quite a big flop, and they're interested in building a competitor to the like the SNES and the Mega Drive and that kind of late 80s 16-bit console era. And the project they came up with was called the Panther. And like I say, Martin Brennan from Flare was brought on as kind of the lead developer and as a consultant on that particular project. Ultimately, the Panther, I mean, that's a whole story in and of itself. I don't know if you want to go into that. But ultimately, the Panther was cancelled right at the last minute, even though they had working prototypes out there and sort of game developers working on games and stuff. And then he was kind of working on... in parallel on the Jaguar, of course. So he also had a lot of input into the Atari Jaguar, and a lot of the sort of 2D sprite hardware that was developed in conjunction with Flare went on to be incorporated into that as well. So quite a big influence on kind of early 90s Atari and the Jaguar in particular.
Well, you mentioned the 7800 and. It was a bit of a flop. Do you know why this kind of happened, or what do you think happened there?
Yeah, so the 7800 was a bit of a weird one, really. I mean, you have to bear in mind that it was kind of released to compete with the likes of the NES and the Master System and later on the SNES and the Mega Drive, of course. And when you compare it to that kind of era of consoles, it was severely lacking, to put it politely, particularly the audio capabilities. They basically decided that they weren't going to put a dedicated audio chip in it, and just kind of reuse the chip from the 2600. So graphically, it wasn't, I mean, it certainly wasn't on par with the 16-bit machines, but it wasn't horrific. But then obviously you're playing these games and you've just got, you know, your very basic beeps and boops coming out of the speaker. And when you compare that to some of the stuff that was on the NES and on the Master System, it was like, you know, what are they playing at? It's and the market responded accordingly. You know, it was a complete flop. And I think they realized that. And I think that there was kind of a mad panic internally at Atari to release something decent as kind of a follow up to that. Personally, I love it as a console. I think it's flawed, but it's certainly got its charm. And of course, it's fully backwards compatible with the 2600 as well. So, if you get your hands on a 7800 and kind of mod it, so you've got a nice clean S video output and a composite video output, It's a great way to play 2600 games. So I guess it's useful for that, if nothing else.
And I guess it's hard to release anything after the crash of 1983 as well, you know, just to kind of get people's confidence and get a machine out there, you know.
Yeah, that, I think that's become a bit of a controversial subject just lately. You know, a lot of debate about whether it actually happened and whether it was a thing outside of America or whether it was purely an Atari thing and all of that kind of thing as well. But yeah, Atari were pushing their luck a bit with the 2600 and kind of repackaging it and you know, trying to reinvent it for, I mean, it was on the market for how long? You know, 20 years plus in various different forms, which is completely unheard of. I don't think there's any other console that has had that much life kind of wrung out of it by its inventor. So, yeah.
Still on sale today in some ways, isn't it? The 2600 and the VCS.
Well, true. So yeah, its DNA does live on in various forms. So, yeah.
Well, you mentioned about the Panther before, and I've always found that a fascinating system, because I'm a big fan of the Jaguar, and obviously the Panther was kind of the, like you mentioned, the cancelled predecessor of that. And I know there are some prototypes out there. I mean, how much do you kind of know about the Panther and its capabilities? And I mean, what was it kind of on par with then? Was it kind of up to Super Nintendo or Mega Drive standard, or where did it kind of sit in that market, would you say?
I've done a huge amount of research on the Panther. So just a quick plug, there is a huge page of research on my website. I started looking into it quite a while back, and there's so much information out there, but it's all kind of spread out across forums and stuff. So I started kind of putting it together, just like I always do when I'm kind of preliminarily sort of working on the early stages of a video. And decided to put it all on my website, and I was contacted by someone, a guy called Ross Siliphant, who's working on a book called Games That Weren't, which is published by Bitmap Books. And he'd done a huge amount of research and interviewed a lot of people behind the scenes and a lot of ex-Atari people and people at various developers who'd been involved with the Panther, and basically said to me, you know, the Panther wasn't at a point that they wanted to... that they felt that there was anything substantial that they could include in the book. But they didn't want his research to go to waste. So basically I could have it all, do what I would, you know, whatever I wanted with it, put it on my website, make a video about it, all of that kind of stuff. And I was just handed this huge amount of research on the Atari Panther, which is really, really cool. And I put it all out there, obviously, because it's I want it to be out there. And that's kind of why I do this. That's kind of my motivation for this. So yeah, it was a very interesting system. It used the 68,000 CPU, same as the ST and the Amiga and the Mega Drive, and the Neo Geo quite famously. But it was clocked at 16 megahertz. And if you bear in mind that I think the Mega Drive was like 7 megahertz, and the Neo Geo was 12. It had much, much faster CPU than either of those systems. And it also had a really, really powerful dedicated 2D sprite capabilities, sprite scaling and rotation and scrolling and all that stuff. A really, really sophisticated graphics chip. And the sound chip that they used was made by a company called Ensoniq, who made synthesizers and that kind of stuff back in the 80s. And I think they were aiming it sort of quite squarely at the Neo Geo, at the really, really high end of the market. And by all accounts, you know, from the developers that worked on it, including Jeff Minter, who was sort of very high up at a consultant level working on that system, it was a really, really powerful machine. The trouble is, I think it just came a little bit too late. The Mega Drive and the SNES were really well established, and the N64 and the PlayStation were kind of on the horizon, and it was becoming obvious that 3D was kind of going to be the future of gaming. And they'd kind of reused some of the technology that they developed for that system in the Jaguar, and kind of wanted to push that as a 3D system. And it just got to a point where they said, well, you know, we don't want to release a kind of last generation 2D system and kind of cannibalize the Jaguar. So we'll cancel it and just release that, which I think is a shame because, like I say, it was really advanced. It had a lot of stuff that was already up and running on it. And by all accounts, it was a really, really impressive system. But ultimately, probably the right decision as far as Atari were concerned.
Yeah, for a company like trying to juggle the launch of two consoles that close together, that would have been quite a balancing act, I think, wouldn't it? But I'm looking at the list of games that were, you know, in development for it. I mean, Psygnosis were working on Shadow of the Beast for it. Domark were doing a Pantherport Pit Fighter as well. And then you had stuff like Cybermorph and Raiden that obviously came out in the Jaguar after that as well. So it does look like it was, yeah, pretty much at a almost ready to be released state when it got canned.
Yeah, there was allegedly a serious hardware bug with it. I know Leonard Tramiel was quite heavily involved in the development of the Panther, and he was kind of working on the software development environment for it, which was ultimately ran natively on the ST and the TT. And he was kind of working with developers trying to find a workaround for this hardware bug. And, you know, the hardware side of Atari weren't going to give him any budget to kind of redevelop the chip or anything like that. So ultimately, probably the right decision. And because of the hardware that they were using, it would have been a very expensive machine. And it would have been a thoroughly 2D machine in an age when the N64 and the PlayStation were kind of just starting to appear. So... Yeah, a good business decision to go with the Jaguar, I think, but a real shame.
I was wondering, do you think if they'd kind of released the Panther, there wouldn't have been that huge gap between, you know, machines coming out in the games world? Did that kind of affect their dominance in the video games market?
Yeah, well, the games division and the home computer divisions at Atari were kind of notoriously... at odds with each other. I get the impression they didn't get along. I mean, much earlier on, kind of in the 8-bit era, they took the original plan was for the Atari 400 and the 800 to actually be a games console, to be the 5200, which would have been the successor to the 2600. And right at the last minute, the home computer division came along and said, oh no, we want this hardware for ourselves. We're going to release this as a computer. Now, of course, they did sit on that for a few years and eventually released that as the 5200. But because the two divisions didn't get along and couldn't agree on anything, the home computer division put their foot down and said, no, you can use our technology and you can release this console, but we're not going to allow you to make it compatible with all of the games that are already out there for the 8-bit computers. So they made some very minimal changes at a low level to like the operating system and move some stuff around in memory addresses and stuff. And released a console that wasn't compatible with the sort of huge back catalogue of games that was out there. So yeah, the 5200, really great console, and developers had to go out and adapt all of their games to run on it. And then ultimately, it was on the market for less than a year, so before it got cancelled. So very strange decision that, but I think it's very telling of kind of what the culture was like at Atari at the time, and kind of the rivalry between the two divisions, if you like.
Yeah, and that wasn't limited to just Atari. You know, you had Sega fighting each other. You had every company kind of struggled with internal conflicts.
And I think as well, I mean, that time, the late 80s, early 90s, I mean, Atari were a very busy company. I mean, you mentioned there, you know, their re-establishment into the console market with the Panther, then the Jaguar. But they weren't taking their foot off the gas with the computers either. I mean, they were upgrading the ST. Obviously, we've got the Atari STE model that was enhanced with a Blitter from memory. It's got better sound capabilities as well. Then obviously, we've got the Falcon that came out in 1992. But in between that, there was a really interesting prototype that I must admit, I don't know all that much about. Maybe you can explain a bit more about what this is. Kind of the gap between the STE and the Falcon, which was the Atari Sparrow.
Yeah, so the story of the Falcon is quite interesting. I mean, it's Atari, so I suppose that's to be expected. But yeah, so the Falcon was in development, and it was going to be this super powerful machine that was going to, you know, destroy the Amiga. And you know, it was based on the, it was going to run the 68040, I think, and really, really sort of ridiculously powerful machine. But as kind of a backup plan, a kind of a side project, they were also developing this machine called the Sparrow, which was kind of the next generation ST after the SDE, based on the same architecture as the ST and all that stuff. Now, as it happens, as it kind of transpires within Atari, rather than going with the much more powerful machine that they had in development, they decided to take the Sparrow and release that as the Falcon. Still a really impressive machine, but unfortunately, not quite as great as it could have been. But yeah, I do own a prototype Sparrow motherboard, which was found at Atari's offices in New York when they were shut down in the mid-90s. Really, really common story with Atari that, you know, after they shut down, a lot of people got sort of bought up the assets in the old buildings and the old offices and that kind of stuff. And they went in there and they found all these really weird prototypes and things that they've been working on. A lot of cancelled stuff that had never sort of seen the light of day, and you know, just like cupboards and cupboards full of stuff. So yeah, it's all highly collectible. But yeah, yet again, it's a story of you know, something that could have been far greater than it ended up being. Not wanting to dismiss the Falcon in any way, because it was a great machine when it came out. But again, interesting to think about what could have been.
Actually, you mentioned the Atari Falcon, and you know, I've got vivid memories of reading about it in magazines back in 1992. And like you mentioned, that was Atari's attempt to really, you know, destroy the Amiga in many ways, because it was up against the Amiga 1200. And I remember Amiga magazines tried to, you know, kind of make out like the A1200 was a better machine, but the Falcon on paper, you know, on specs, absolutely buried the Amiga 1200. I mean, what memories have you got about seeing that machine? And as like an ST fan, were you excited when you started hearing about the Falcon?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly was. I mean, we got our STE in 1991, Christmas 91, and we used to get ST Format every month, which was sort of the big Atari ST magazine. And I remember they were really bigging up the Falcon as sort of the next big thing. And of course, it had the 68030 CPU, which was obviously better than the Amiga 1200 68020. And you know, as a kid, I remember seeing it and thinking, oh, you know, you're seeing the screenshots of some of those early games and stuff, and you know, reading about its audio capabilities and how it was going to be the next big thing in music production and all that kind of thing. And it's a really, really exciting thing. But ultimately, I think it suffered from the same fate as kind of the other stuff that Atari were doing in the early 90s. And just kind of, I think the developers weren't supported very well and kind of lost faith in it. And ultimately, when it was released, there wasn't a huge amount of software available for it. And it's a shame, really. It was really, it had a huge amount of potential. And I think even now it's perhaps not living up to that potential. But certainly at the time, as a kid, as an impressionable young kid playing games on his Atari ST, it was like, oh, you know, that looks amazing. I'd love to get my hands on one of those.
I've got to ask, Reese, have you got one in your collection today?
I haven't, no. I remember a few years back when I first started collecting Atari stuff, you could pick them up on eBay, you know, boxed in, basically brand new in box for like 200-300, you know, maybe 400 quid for a really, really nice one. But there were just no games available for them and no software available for them. And I just thought, well, you know, why would anyone want one of those? It's pretty much useless. And of course, nowadays they sell for, well, they can sell for upwards of sort of £2,000. So kind of kicking myself a bit, thinking, yeah, you know, should have grabbed one when I had the chance, really.
They also released like some insane versions. Like I saw that there was a 060 version, and there was like some third party ones as well. One was called the Eagle, and they had some like tower kind of designs and stuff like that.
Yeah, so it's quite interesting that the Falcon, of all things, kind of launched this whole market for clones. So I think there was one called the Medusa, one called the Hades. And they were upgraded as well, because obviously you could upgrade the 68030 CPU with a you know, 040 or 060. People took it really, really far, and I think they were putting like 128 mega RAM in them and all sorts of high resolution graphics cards. And when Atari eventually went pop in sort of 96-ish, whenever it was, I think it was a German company called C-Lab picked up the rights to the Falcon. And they actually went on and carried on making it, I think into the early 2000s, and they made like rack mounted versions and all sorts of stuff that were used in the music production industry. So yeah, interesting that it kind of took on this second life as this kind of specialized thing as well.
Yeah, and one thing, obviously, the big legacy from the Falcon is, you know, they're doing like a little tower version of it that actually, bizarrely, you know, just one of these weird things in Atari history, actually went on to really inspire, and I think was officially licensed to be the design of the PlayStation 2.
Yes, that's a very good point. I think it was called the Falcon Microbox or something like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, earlier I was talking about the Sparrow and the Falcon. and how they were kind of two separate projects, and they actually took the Sparrow project and decided to run with that and make that the Falcon. Well, the upright sort of PS2 style design was actually the original Falcon project. But when Sony released the PlayStation 2 and they tried to patent the design, I think they had to actually cite that as a prior example. I think Atari already had the patent on it or something, if I recall correctly. So, yeah, it looked like it was going to be a really cool little machine, just like a little sort of desktop, like a modern small form factor system. But, yeah, in 1992, that would have been really impressive.
Yes, if no one's seen this before, I mean, if you Google Atari Micro Box, and you'll see, it literally looks just like a white PS2 vertically, doesn't it? It's like, really similar. So let's get into the Atari Jaguar a bit more. And I know you and I, both fans of the Jaguars. I've nearly got a complete collection. I don't know kind of where you're at with yours. I'm looking over at my my Atari Jaguar CD next to me as well.
He doesn't, doesn't shut up about Atari carts. That's
I've got Atari carts. I'm at so of the 50 commercial cartridge releases, I think I've got 46 or 47 now. There's only a couple of games I'm missing.
I'm about the same.
The really expensive ones. But I haven't got a Jag CD because, yet again, that's something I didn't pick up when I had the opportunity.
Again, I got mine. I think I paid £300 for a Jaguar with a CD.
Wow.
Back in like 2014. So, and they're obviously quite rare today. But I mean, I've always liked the Jag because I think it was that strange era when that kind of generation that came along, like the 3DO and the CD32, between the 16-bit mighty machines, the Mega Drive and the Super Nintendo, and the PlayStation coming along and just decimating everything. And what are kind of your memories of the Jaguar then when it came along? So I remember, obviously, they were hyping that up as, the first powerful 64-bit console. Were you kind of really excited when you first heard about the Jag?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I remember reading those ST format magazines when I was a kid, and the Jag was another thing that they were really sort of hyping up at the time. Obviously, I think it was kind of known at the time that Atari were kind of on the back foot and kind of struggling a bit. And the Jag was going to be the thing that was going to save them and kind of, kind of carry them well into the 90s. And seeing some of those early screenshots and stuff, certainly seeing them kind of static printed in a magazine, stuff like, I laugh because I'm going to say Club Drive. That was one that they were really pushing. Obviously, in hindsight, it's not been perhaps remembered quite so fondly.
But it was 3D and we didn't have 3D.
Well, exactly. So, yeah. Seeing that those sort of fully 3D rendered, as blocky as it was, cars driving around in a city and stuff. There was nothing else like that at the time. And to be fair to Atari, I mean, when the Jaguar was first announced and when the first consoles kind of started to appear, there was nothing else like it on the market. And it was the most powerful 3D console on the market at the time. It was very short lived. And the fact that they had manufacturing issues that meant that it took them, over a year for them to actually start pumping them out in any kind of considerable numbers, kind of ruined the whole thing for them. But at the time, it was a huge amount of promise. And as a kid, it was just like, how cool is that? And to be fair, even as an adult, 30 years later, getting on for 30 years later, it's like, I love it. And it's nice that it's got such a passionate sort of following in this day and age, definitely.
You mentioned those kind of problems with manufacturing. I mean, we had Daryl Still, who was the manager of Atari UK at the time, and he had the job of launching the Jaguar. We had him on the show a couple of years ago, and he mentioned that, the fact that they just couldn't manufacture enough for that Christmas market. And, that could have maybe made it a much more popular console if they could just get enough of them out there. It was just seemed like it was a series of unfortunate events, really, I suppose, with the launch of it.
Yeah, well, of course, the hardware was actually manufactured by IBM, which was quite surprising. So, manufactured to a very high standard. But yeah, it was just kind of so exotic and so specialist at the time, and with Atari being kind of as dysfunctional as they were, unfortunately, they missed that first Christmas, and like I say, it kind of took a year for them to sort of get fully up to speed on it. By which point, people were talking about the N64 and the PlayStation, and it was kind of a little bit too late.
But apparently, a lot of the SDKs, like software development kit and developers units and stuff, weren't really up to scratch and quite buggy, and this led to a lot of ports just of lesser games and stuff, and put off kind of third party stuff. What why else do you think there was not many third-party titles on the Jaguar?
Yeah, it was notoriously difficult to work with the Tom and Jerry chips in there, which are the kind of the specialist audio and graphics chips in the Jaguar. And they put the 68,000 CPU in there, which was obviously the same CPU that had been used in the ST, and of course the Amiga, the Mega Drive, and all that kind of stuff. So a lot of developers, because they weren't receiving very good support from Atari and very good documentation on the custom chips, kind of fell back to the 68,000 and kind of lent on that quite heavily. And there are a fair few games that kind of don't use the Jag's specialist hardware to its full potential, just because, you know, they fell back on that chip because it meant that they could get games released and get something to market. Yeah, so the obviously the development kit for the Jag was kind of a continuation of what they developed for the Panther, running on the Atari TT-030. So it was kind of a thing that was kind of tethered to that and allowed developers to kind of load games onto it, kind of run them from memory and that kind of stuff. And I know that Jeff Minter was also involved in the development of that as well. And I think Leonard Trammell was kind of on the software side of it. But yeah, I guess because they kind of pulled all of their resources into the Panther, and then kind of decided to very quickly finish off the Jag and actually release that instead, I guess the software side of it and the SDK and the developer support wasn't quite there. And of course, a lot of the developers, I think, probably felt like they'd kind of been burnt a bit on the Panther because they'd put so much work into developing games for it, only for it to be pulled at the very last second. And then it was like, oh, you know, okay, it's all about the Jag now. Well, do we really want to invest all of our resources into this now, or is the same thing going to happen again? So just quite a combination of events, I think, that combination of circumstances at the time that led to the developers not being all that confident in it.
And I think you think of the market in like 93, 94. I mean, today we've got like three consoles. But then, you know, you think 93, you still had the Super Nintendo had only been out a year. Mega Drive was still selling like hotcakes. You had the 3DO, CD32, you had the Jaguar, you knew the PlayStation and the Sega Saturn were on the horizon. Nintendo had this Project Reality thing coming out. So as a developer and even as a consumer, kind of, it was really hard to know which one to back, I guess. So that probably had a big impact on sales and developer confidence as well.
Yeah, you would think that developers would have a lot of confidence in Atari with kind of the history and the, you know, the kind of the provenance and the weight that name would carry. But of course, they'd had a pretty bad run of consoles. Obviously, they had the Panther that had been cancelled, and they'd had the 7800, which hadn't done very well at all. And then previously to that, they had the 5200, which had been pulled after only a year. So I can certainly see why developers weren't keen on working with them at the time.
Well, one thing that the Atari Jaguar was really ahead of its time in and very innovative, and I was actually quite pleased to see that there is going to be a version of Atari Jaguar's Missile Command on the Atari 50 collection. And that is quite a unique game because it is the only game in the Jaguar's library that supports the unreleased Atari Jaguar virtual reality headset. Now, people who haven't heard about this might be like, what? There was a VR headset for the Jaguar?
Yes, so a really interesting thing. And another thing that was kind of being really pushed by the magazines at the time and that was sort of really amazed by as a kid. I remember the Virtuality Machines, which is actually, I've since found out, is a company that is local to me, that's actually based in my hometown of Leicester, or they were at the time. And they worked with Leicester University to develop that technology. So they were kind of really huge. And they actually worked with Atari on this headset for the Jaguar. And it was another one of these really strange projects that was sort of really, really advanced, and they'd got it all working. And by all accounts, I mean, there are working prototypes out there that are in the hands of people. You know, I've seen video footage of them working, and by all accounts, it worked really, really well. And like you say, there was Missile Command 3D, which supported it. And yet again, it was just one of those things where Atari was kind of at that stage in its life cycle where it was just kind of in the process of imploding. And unfortunately, it didn't make it to market. But really, really impressive thing to see in action. Well worth having a look at some YouTube videos and stuff, just seeing those kind of prototype units working. Because, I mean, how amazing would that have been in you know, the mid-90s, a virtual reality headset that you could just plug in and use at home? And something that we didn't get until very, very recently with obviously stuff like the Oculus Rift and that kind of thing. So well ahead of its time.
So ahead of its time.
Yeah, definitely.
I think, actually, there is a prototype, isn't there, at the Retro Computing Museum in Leicester? I don't think it's working, but you can go and see it there if you want to kind of see what it looked like.
Yes, I actually went there quite recently myself, but they didn't let me play with it, so that's a shame. But no, I did get to play on one of the virtuality machines, so definitely well worth a visit.
That's worth the trip.
I think that's Dan's dream, to one day find a pristine VR unit. Yeah, just open that up. I was wondering as well, did they have any like future plans for like Jaguars, like a Jaguar 2 or anything like that?
They did, yes. They were working on something called the Jag Duo, which was the Jaguar console with the CD unit actually incorporated into it, all into one console. A really sleek looking CD based console. Of course, that ended up not happening. And they also did sort of carry that through to a Jaguar 2, and they were working on a new graphics chip, which I believe they had working prototypes of. And the Jaguar 2 was going to be backwards compatible as well, which was something that was quite unusual at the time. So it was going to be fully backwards compatible with all of the existing Jaguar games, but then also support these sort of next generation graphically advanced CD-based games as well. Again, another thing that unfortunately didn't end up happening because of Atari's state of ongoing implosion at the time. But there are prototypes out there. There are pictures on the internet. I don't believe anyone has managed to get one working, which is a shame. But would have been a really cool thing to see, I think.
And the CD unit as well. I mean, I've got one of those, and they launched pretty late in the Jaguar's life. I think it was like end of 95 when that came out. So you're talking, I mean, PlayStation was on the market by then. Mm. And only like 11 games ever came out on that. Yeah. But it did kind of feel like it's weird because you see the announcements of the Jaguar, and there are videos online where you can see Leonard and Sam Tramiel launching it and talking about the CD right at the launch of the system back in 93. But obviously it took them such a long time to get it out there. It just felt like they missed the boat on the CD market, I guess.
Yeah, and I think a lot of those CD games, having played them, I don't own a Jaguar CD, but I have got the game drive flash cart, which supports the CD games. Mm. Having played them, I think they suffer from, you know, the same sort of issues as the other very early CD based stuff, in that developers didn't really know what to do with all the extra storage space. And, you know, you've got impressive pre-rendered FMV cutscenes and stuff, but the actual gameplay of the games themselves, I don't think really fully takes advantage of the technology. But cool to see what they were doing with it at the time. And like you say, yeah, CD was certainly in their plans from the very beginning. And they were also working on a CD drive for the ST as well, which never saw the light of day.
Yeah, so there are some games on there that I think, you know, Iron Soldier 2 is worth a play. And you've got Battle Morph as well, which is the follow-up to the famous Cybermorph. That actually, I think, is a better game, Battle Morph, on the CD. But obviously, just because there were such limited releases and no one really played them, I think, you know, like you mentioned today, there is a flash cart available for the Jaguar, and obviously you can play these on emulation. So there are definitely a few kind of hidden gems in the 11 games that were released on the Jaguar CD.
Yeah, there was some really sort of unique and interesting stuff on the Jaguar, and I think that's what makes it interesting as a console. You know, because they were kind of among those very first sort of 3D capable consoles, that they didn't really know what to do with the technology, and they kind of tried a lot of interesting stuff. And I think that's kind of what makes it unique and what makes it interesting to collect for.
Well, interestingly, the Atari Jaguar case has been repurposed a couple of times. one of them was the ill-fated Coleco Chameleon as well, which was a crazy project. And another one was dental machines as well. And I know people kind of love this idea. Do you think we're going to see the Jaguar case come back in another form at any time? Or what do you think about these kind of machines? Does anybody collect the dental Jaguars at all?
I'd actually quite like one for the collection, just because it's a cool looking thing. The interesting thing is they used the cartridge slot as well, didn't they? For like an add-on or a memory expansion or something. Because it was a dental camera that they turned it into. But when Hasbro got their hands on all of Atari's assets, sort of 96, 97-ish, or whenever it was, or I think possibly a bit later than that, actually. They basically released all of the Jaguar stuff into the public domain. So, you know, all the patents on the case design and the hardware and all of sort of the encryption stuff for the Jaguar CD, which is why there was quite a lot of sort of homebrew stuff that started to appear on it around that time. And yeah, one of the things they did was they sold the case molds, obviously for the cases were injection molded. So they had the proper, very expensive molds made. And they sold those to a dental company who went on to use it for a camera, as you do. And yeah, like you say, the Coleco Chameleon, and who knows, like I say, that case design is in the public domain. So I'm not quite sure who claims to own it at the moment, but could certainly come back in some form or
I'd
another.
I'd love to see a robot vacuum cleaner that was a Jaguar. That would be really cool.
I want one of those dental cases as well, though, because, I mean, if people haven't seen them, it's pretty much just a white Jaguar shell, isn't it? Yeah, I've seen people putting, like, blue LEDs in and actually, you know, fitting these onto the Jaguars, and they look amazing.
Oh, wow. Yeah, designed to be wall-mounted as well, I think. So, yeah, that'd be cool.
I mean, talking about the Jaguar today, I mean, I've got some of the new Pro controllers that were made in the last couple of years, and they're still quite inactive. Maybe not as much as, like, systems like the Dreamcast, but there is still quite a big homebrew community and fans of the Jaguar. It's still quite an active community today, isn't it?
Yeah, I did pick up some of those Pro controllers as well. I think they've actually stopped making them now, so I'm quite glad I managed to grab some when I did, because they're really cool, especially for games like Doom that supported them at the time. I think they were worth having for the shoulder buttons and stuff. But yeah, the obviously the homebrew scene on the Jag is quite big now, especially with the flash cart coming out as well. I think that's definitely going to help on that side of things. A lot of stuff that you see are kind of straight ports from the ST and the Amiga versions, obviously using that 68,000 CPU. But I think for such a rare, well, not rare in the grand scheme of things, but considering the Jag wasn't a big seller compared to the likes of the SNES and the Mega Drive and stuff, I think it does have a really, really interesting and really active homebrew scene. So that's really cool to see. Not something I've played with myself, but maybe one day.
And I think it might be because there are a lot of retro gaming fans who've maybe explored all of the major consoles libraries, and then you kind of want to see a bit more what else is out there. And, you know, there probably are people that heard of the Jaguar but maybe have never played a game on it before. So I think there's definitely some kind of intrigue there as well. And I imagine, obviously, the kind of stuff you cover on your channel, you do a lot more to kind of explain all this Atari history and stuff too. I mean, what else can we see in your channel? And what's coming up then? Have you got any plans for more Atari content soon?
Oh, there's always stuff in the pipeline. Yeah, I got a bit sidetracked by PCs. I really got into IBM PCs over kind of the past year or so, and I must admit I've kind of neglected the Atari content. I did a video quite recently on the ST and some of the kind of the modern add-ons for that. But there's so much stuff here. I mean, I'm sat here looking at it all, thinking, you know, what do I cover next, kind of thing. So I've got an original Pong machine. I've got a couple of those that'd be quite nice to cover. Some of their really, really early hardware, like the video pinball and the stunt cycle and that kind of thing. I really want to do sort of the history of those, the sort of pre-2600 1970s stuff. Yeah, the 5200. I think that's a really underrated console that's doesn't get enough coverage. When I do finally get my hands on all of those Jaguar games, I would really like to do, I don't know whether I want to do it as some kind of epic documentary length video, or maybe a live stream or something like that, but it would be really cool to just sort of sit down and go through all of those games and just kind of show all of those off as well, because I don't think that's the thing that's really been done before.
I was wondering if you had any Lynx content as well, if you'd done any stuff about the Lynx as well. So we're not mentioning that yet.
Yeah, I have a Lynx and I collect Lynx stuff. I did a very brief video on it as part of a collaboration thing called My Cool Machine earlier this year, just talking about the Lynx and why I think it's an awesome console. So yeah, I got some Mister footage that I captured just to show off some of the games on the Lynx, because I think it's another one that's similar to the Jaguar in that it had some really interesting and unique games on it that perhaps people aren't aware of. So it's cool to kind of show those off and share those.
And if people want to read, you mentioned those Panther documents before as well. What's your website if people want to check that out?
Yeah, so that's control-alt-reese.com, control-alt-reese.com. But if you search for Atari Panther, it will be, I think it's the top result now anyway. So there's really not much information out there about it.
Amazing. Well, listen, it's incredible that you're doing this documentation of these fantastic systems and, you know, really showing some love to, you know, I could talk about the Atari Jaguar with you all night. You know, one of my all-time favourite consoles. So keep up the good work on the channel, and control.reese on YouTube as well. Obviously, I'll put a link to your website and your YouTube channel in the podcast description. So thank you so much for coming on and chatting with us, Reese. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, no, thank you very much for having me. It's been a lot of fun.